Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Now, The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report, Contracts. Where is it in the law? When we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world. We believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School, the fourth largest law school in the United States. Here's what he said about these budding young lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that. Most of the students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax." Unquote. So says Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send an email request for that free general law CD package, would you? Remember, it's free of charge. Do it right now before you forget. georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we broke into the subject of contracts with a letter that I received from a fellow named Raymond. He said, "I've often heard it said that certain government documents are in fact contracts, such as driver's license, voting registration, and social security numbers. My question is this, is it explicitly stated or recorded in any case law, record, statute, or code that this is indeed a fact? In other words, I know and I've heard by repetitive hearsay that this is the case, but has the government ever admitted, stated, or acknowledged that this is a fact of law? The answer to your question, Ray, is yes. Or is it merely an assumption made by implication, deduction, and reason? The answer to that is no, it is not. And my human reason and my opinions don't count. So when I come on the air and I say, well, these driver's licenses and marriage licenses and birth certificates and social security numbers are contracts that you enter into with government and they're extra constitutional, Ray wants to know, well, where does it say that in the law? He went on to say, well, you know, why don't you steer me in the right direction? So last time I steered you into two directions, two sources of information. One was Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 1914 model. And the other was Corpus Juris Secundum or American Jurisprudence, two legal encyclopedias. Now, that's a beginning. That tells us what the definition of a contract is. Remember, a contract, when you look up contract in Bouvier, it's going to tell you, after about, I don't know, 6 or 8 pages of material, that a contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. 4 elements to a contract. And that a license is not a contract, and it explicitly tells you that a license is not a contract, that it's something different than a contract. And it explains the license and what it is. And so I just want to point out that a license is an offer with your acceptance over time with consideration. Now, I'll let you decide whether a license is a contract by definition, simply because it's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, even though the government tells you, no, it's not. In fact, the legal encyclopedias tell you, no, it's not. It's something else. It's an extraordinary contract. It's something different than a contract. It's a super contract. I'll show you that as we progress along. But you know, government lies a lot. The government lied to us about the Lusitania attack in 1915. They said that the Lusitania was a private passenger ship and wasn't carrying munitions. 50 years later, our government admitted, after 50 years, and all the people that were involved in the war in 1915, 16, 17 were dead and buried, that yes, indeed, it was carrying munitions. And not only was it carrying munitions, it was carrying munitions of a special caliber manufactured in the United States in special munitions plants to fit special British guns with a special British caliber, while America was officially neutral. Of course, the Germans knew about that, and they sunk the ship. Why would we do such a thing? Well, then, here again, you know, government lies. They lied to us about Pearl Harbor. Lied to us about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Lied to us about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, you know, come on, guys. Government lies a lot. Government has an agenda. And in order to carry out that agenda, from time to time, government lies. They don't lie to us all the time. Government lies to us about 75% of the time. Maybe it's only 25% of the time. I don't know. And then they tell us the truth 75% of the time. Or maybe they tell us the truth 25% of the time. I don't know. But they mix the lies with the truth and keeps us confused continuously. And that's where reality's at. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. And even if your IQ is down around 80 or 85, you know you ought to be able to figure that out. All right, now let's get on with the next piece of the formula here for determining whether or not we're dealing with contracts or we're dealing with something else. And if you're not dealing with a contract, what are you dealing with? Well, I guess we're dealing with a law. Well, then what is a law? Last time I showed you that a law is the rules of the game. It's the way we play the game of Monopoly. It's the way we play the game of Social Security. It's the way we play the income tax. There are rules and regulations that are set down. Now, you and I, when we think of a contract, we think of a meeting of the minds. But there is a type of contract called an adhesion contract. We'll take a look at adhesion contracts as we progress along, and I'll show you that there are contracts out there that you probably can't even spell, can't even pronounce the name, that are binding upon you, and that you're involved with, whether you know it or not, or whether you intended to or not. I mean, that's just the way life is. I didn't make it that way. Don't blame me. I'm just a reporter. I don't make these laws, rules, and regulations. I don't make the definitions of licenses or contracts and stick them into your legal dictionaries or legal encyclopedias. I just got here in 1939, and when I got here, it was already in full force and effect, and it was already working that way. So I didn't have anything to do with creating it. I pointed out to you last time there's 2 forms of law on planet Earth, the civil law and the common law. So let's take a look at a particular law in Idaho that I had a direct interest in. It's called Idaho Code 492927. If you got a pencil or paper there in front of you, if you don't get it, and if you do, why, sharpen your pencil now on both ends and write this down, because I'm going to take you through a little drill here, and I'll show you what contracts and license are all about as it relates to code pleading. Now, remember our listener, Raymond, he wants to know, is there any code, is there any statute that's involved here? Yes, there are laws, cases, records, statutes, and codes that tell us that these are contracts. And sometimes explicitly and sometimes not so explicitly. In fact, there's an adage in law that goes like this. The intent of the lawmaker is the law. The intent of the lawmaker is the law. And oftentimes a court will go to the intent of the legislation. And if they can find the intent of the committee, the intent of the lawmakers, then they can determine how that statute is to be construed. And this is the case in Idaho Code 492927. So let's take a look at intent. I took a look at Article 1, Section 9 of the Federal Constitution, and when I read it, I came to a conclusion that you can't compel a truck to stop in or clear and pay duties in a port of entry because it's a vessel. Take a look at Article 1, Section 9 of your Constitution where it talks about vessels. And so I had my truck and I was driving down the road and I got to the Bliss Way Station. And I didn't pull in and stop in or clear and pay duties in the port of entry. I just drove right on by. And then nothing happened. And I did that three or four times. And then finally, Officer Mogenden came out and he stopped me and he said, "Hey, you, how come you didn't stop back there at the scale and weigh your truck like everybody else does?" And I said, "Because of Article 1, Section 9 of the Federal Constitution that bars you from getting out here on the highway and messing with me." Well, Officer Mogenden, you know, he wasn't too impressed with that, and so he arrested me and hauled me off to jail. So after going through the process and getting back out on the road, we now had an issue that we could argue clear up to the U.S. Supreme Court. On our way to Washington, we had a couple of stop-offs. The first stop-off was at the Magistrates Court in Gooding, Idaho. We had to try the case first there in front of a jury. Well, you don't have to try the case in front of a jury, but I thought that that was probably the wise thing to do. After all, I'd been reading a lot of patriot literature and fully informed jury information, and so I demanded a jury trial. And so one day we were in court arguing a motion hearing. And in that motion hearing, I'd raised about 10 or 12 issues, you know, about sua sponte and jury trial and motions to dismiss and one thing and another. And the judge in the case, his name was Judge Becker. Now, of course, at the time, he looked like an old man to me. He must have been 40. You know, this is back about 1980. You know, a guy that's 40 years old, you know, he's kind of an ancient old fart, and he looked like an ancient old man to me. And as we were arguing this motion hearing, the judge interrupted me and he said, "Now, Mr. Gordon, let me pause right here. I'm sorry to interrupt you." He said, "This truck that allegedly failed to stop in or clear and pay duties in the port of entry, Mr. Gordon, is this company, the Atlantis Manufacturing Company, Incorporated, the owner of that truck?" And I said, "Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes. Atlantis Manufacturing Company, Incorporated, is the owner of that truck." And he said, "Okay, thank you." And he noted that down in his notes. And he said, "You can proceed." And so I proceeded to wax eloquent. And as I was describing to the judge Article 1, Section 9 of the Federal Constitution and giving the judge a lesson in civics, the judge paused again and he says, "I'm terribly sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Gordon, but I got to ask another question here. I'm drifting off and I want to make sure that I understand your argument." He said, "This truck that's owned by Atlantis Manufacturing Company Incorporated, is this truck engaged in any form of interstate commerce? That means, does it go across state lines like into Utah or Wyoming or Oregon?" I said, "Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Why, we sell our products in 11 western states." And he noted that down in his in his notes, and he said, well, you can proceed, Mr. Gordon. So I proceeded to wax eloquent and explain to the judge the ramifications of the Founding Fathers' intent concerning Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, and continued on with my civics lesson. And pretty soon the judge, he got confused again. The judge, you know, he's a little old. I don't know if he's suffering from Alzheimer's or what, but he got confused again, and he paused. He stopped, and he said, I'm terribly sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Gordon, but I'm confused again. He admitted he was confused. He told me plainly, he says, I'm not sure I follow the argument. Let me ask you this question. He says, is this truck owned by the Atlantis Manufacturing Company, an Idaho corporation, engaged in interstate commerce? Is this truck engaged in any intrastate commerce? I said, oh, yes, sir. We have accounts all over the state of Idaho while we deliver our products in Idaho Falls and Pocatello and Twin Falls and Moscow and Livingston and just all over, you know. And he said, well, thank you very much, and now you can proceed. So I proceeded to describe the law to the judge and explain to him about how all these games are played and about my constitutional rights and how these cops over here had their heads up their wrong ends and one thing and another. And pretty soon I finished my program. It took me about 3 hours. I had 12 motions, 3 hours arguing. And the judge was very patient, listened to all of my arguments, wrote down copious notes. I mean, he had a yellow pad up there, and he was paying attention to everything I said and writing all this down. Later on, the judge had told me, he said, you know, this is judicial Siberia. Well, I'm locked up here in Gooding, Idaho, Gooding County, Idaho. He said, this is the last stop in the judicial process in America. This is like Siberia is in Russia. I didn't know that until the judge had told me. He said, yeah, that's where I am. And so when I finished, prosecutor, he got up and he said a few words. He didn't say anything very eloquent or intelligent that I can recall. But the judge said, well, I'm going to rule on these motions. And so he ruled on several of those motions. In fact, he ruled on all 12 of them. He said, I'm going to grant you that one and deny you that one thing and another. But the thing that he said that was so eloquent that day, I got to share this with you, because it was really the apex of the entire meeting, the entire hearing. He said, ordinarily, Mr. Gordon, when I listen to oral argument like this, I issue a written opinion in 21 days. But he said, in this case, that won't be necessary. In this case, that will not be necessary. So I'm just going to tell you right now today. He said, your motion to dismiss on Article 1, Section 9 is denied. And he said, Mr. Gordon, if you mention the word Constitution in front of the jury during trial, I will hold you in contempt of court, and I will sentence you to 5 days in jail every time you utter the word Constitution in front of the jury. Now, all you good patriots out there, did you hear that commie pinko fag judge's words? Let me repeat it. He said, Mr. Gordon, if you mention the word Constitution in front of the jury, I'll hold you in contempt. Maximum sentence for contempt in Idaho in those days was 5 days. So if I got up there and started arguing about the Constitution and Article 1, Section 9 and all of my constitutional rights and one thing and another, he says, I'm going to throw you in jail. Now you think about that for a minute as you're writing this down now, because we're ready now to take a look at the statute. Well, not quite. Let me tell you a little more of the story. We went into court, and the government puts on their case first. And so the government came in, and they brought in 3 or 4 witnesses that all testified that George Gordon drove by on June 9th, 1978, and didn't stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. And they had to go out and chase me down, bring me back, and one thing and another. And they were pretty upset about that. And they testified that the code that I broke was Idaho Code 49-29-27. So if you want to write that down, check me out. It's Idaho Code 49. And then it's Section 29-27. And that code says this. Now, if you want to write this down, this is very important. Well, We're going to explain a very important piece of law here to you. It's called code pleading. Here's what the statute says. Just write it down. Four words. All trucks loaded with. It's very easy. Just write it down. All trucks loaded with. And then put a colon right after with. Colon. That's two dots, one on top of each other. In case you're not too English literate. Oh, it's all trucks loaded with. Then underneath those four words was a list of 40 items. We won't list all 40 of them here, but I'll give you a little drift here. It says lumber trucks, you know, trucks loaded with lumber. Manufactured products would be number two. Raw materials, number three. You know, and it went on down this list over here, and it just listed about everything there was in the world. If you ever played 20 questions, you know, you wouldn't be able to think of anything that wasn't on the list. And it said manufactured products and raw materials and lumber and shoes and socks and furniture and anything that you can imagine or think of, they had on that list, 40 items in all. And then after the list of 40 things that they had on that list, it said shall. So you write down the word shall, S-H-A-L-L, stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in a port of entry. Period. Period. That's a colon with only one dot instead of two. Period. Shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in a port of entry. That's a simple enough statute. No fuss, no muss. All right, now you got the statute in front of you. Now, we tried the case, and a funny thing happened while we were trying the case. The government came in, put on their case, rested their case at about 5 minutes to 12, and I made a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. Of course, that's my next parliamentary move. You know, when you're doing this, it's kind of like, you know, the rules of procedure, and there's this break in the case. It's called the prima facie break. And at the prima facie break, I said, I move to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. And the judge sat bolt upright. He's leaning back in his chair. Sat bolt upright. Looked me right in the eyeball. And he said, what did the government fail to prove, Mr. Gordon? And I paused. Long, pregnant pause. And I went, And I said, well, I don't know. And the judge just looked at me like I was stupid. You know, like, you want me to dismiss because the state failed to prove something and you don't know what it is they failed to prove? And he said, well, I do, but I won't. Well, it's lunchtime. Now, Mr. Gordon, let's take our break for lunch, and you can put on your case this afternoon at 1:30 when we return. So I went out to eat lunch. Now, remember what the judge said. He said, well, I know what they failed to prove. I do, but I won't. I won't dismiss. I know, but you don't, and I'm not going to dismiss. So I ate my lunch, and it was not a very good lunch. I'll always remember that lunch. It was one of the bad ones. Because in court, unlike a horse race, there are only winners and losers. There's no show and there's no place. Just winners and losers. So lunch wasn't very good that day. And when we came back, I came back about 1:15, and I was sitting down and waiting for the judge to come in, and at 1:30, you know how the bailiff stands up and he says, hear ye, all rise. You know, the judicial district of Gooding is in session, the Honorable Judge Becker presiding, you know, and the judge comes in with a grand entrance, you know, like they do in Hollywood plays. You remember, know how that works? Judge didn't do it this time. In fact, he came in through the back door, you know, where all of the tourists come in. Yeah, just came in the back door. And he comes walking up the aisle. You know, courtrooms are built kind of like churches. He's walking up the aisle toward the bench. In church, you know, you call that the altar. Anyway, he stopped at the defense table, and I was sitting right there next to the aisle. He stopped. He put his hand on my shoulder, and he bent down, and he looked me right in the eyeball as I was sitting there, and I looked up at him and looked him right in the eyeball, and he said, God, I wish I had this case. I'd win it in 5 minutes. And then he went on up and sat down, and He said, okay, everybody, you can... Court's in session. He said, Mr. Gordon, I'd like to listen to your half of the case now. Now, remember, we got a jury trial here. And the jury, you know, is sitting there listening in great anticipation. What does this guy have to say? So I put on my defense, and by about 4:30 that afternoon, I had all my witnesses, evidence, and testimony. My case was presented. I didn't mention the word Constitution a single time, and I didn't go to jail once. Isn't that special? I didn't mention the Constitution once. Now, remember, I said this judge is a commie pinko fag. Remember that I said that about that judge? But now, after the case was over, I could say, you know, that judge is the only guy there that knew whether his rectum was bored or punched. Prosecutor didn't know. I didn't have a clue. The jury didn't know. There's only one guy in the courtroom that really knew what the issues were in the case. I thought it was Article 1, Section 9. Prosecutor thought it was he didn't stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry. Both of us were wrong. There was a third issue that neither one of us had raised, neither one of us knew about, which the case turned on. Judge told me about it later. We'll come to that. I don't want to be anticlimactic, but here we are in the courtroom. Remember, the judge has said, I do, but I won't. He knew what the state had failed to prove at the prima facie break. Comes in and says, God, I wish I had this case. I'd win it in 5 minutes. Goes on up and sits down and presides over the case that I just threw away. Because after 3 hours, 1:30 to 4:30, the jury was charged and sent out to deliberate. While I was sitting in the defense chair in the courtroom, the judge's clerk came in. She didn't have much to say, but she said to me, Mr. Gordon, the judge is available. And she turned on her heel and walked out. So I turned to the guy that was with me, Steve Gibson. I said, Steve, what's that mean? He said, I don't know. Well, you know, I'm kind of a curious type. And I said, well, I guess it's time for us to go find out. So I went back to the clerk's office and I said, you said the judge is available. And she said, yes, right this way, Mr. Gordon. And she led me down through the labyrinths of hallways into the judge's chambers. Not a very spacious or spectacular judge's quarters, you know, in the Gooding County Courthouse. Not bad, but, you know, not like the palaces made for federal judges. So she invited us to sit down, and Steve and I sat down, and the judge came in. And the judge came in like Superman, and he ripped off his cape, you know, his black robe, and he hung it on his coat tray. And he was a pipe smoker, so he whips out his pipe, and he sits down. He looks across the day, says, God, I thought you had him! I thought you had him! But you let him get away. As he leaned back in his chair and started lighting his pipe. You know how these pipe smokers are, you know, billowing clouds of smoke rising in the air as he strikes match after match trying to get this wad of wet leaves to burn in this bowl of a pipe, you know, and we were all sitting there looking at each other kind of awkward as the judge was lighting his pipe. And so the judge opened the conversation and he said, well, how do you think the jury will come back? And I said, I don't know. So I said, well, how do you think the jury will come back? So the judge is sucking on his pipe over there. He blows out a great big billowing cloud of smoke, and he looks across the desk, and he says, oh, they'll come back guilty. All right. Oh, they'll come back guilty, all right, he said. Well, I was a little bit surprised, and I said, well, what makes you think so? And so the judge leaned over, sat up, bowled upright, and he says, because I told them to. Because I told them to. This judge doesn't have much to say, but when he says something, he says a lot, doesn't he? God, I wish I had this case. I'd win it in 5 minutes. I do, but I won't. The judge is available. How do you think the jury will come back? Oh, they'll come back guilty, all right. Why? Because I told them to. That was the substance of our conversation so far. Kind of surprising, isn't it? Remember, I've already told you. The only guy that knew which end was up in this case is the judge. Prosecutor didn't have a clue, nor did the defense have a clue as to what the issues were or how to argue the case. And the judge said, I'd win this case in 5 minutes. Well, we're at the halfway point here, boys and girls. I got to give you a couple of reminders. We'll be back. Don't go away. And we'll tell you why it is that the jury was going to come back guilty. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. You can access it through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 1-417-273-4967. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers or the sponsors or the management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 1-417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, as we were sitting there looking across the desk at the judge had just said, because I told him to, and I was shocked, and I said, when did you tell the jury to come back with a guilty verdict? And he said, with jury instructions number 1 and 2. Jury instructions. Yes? Yes, I remember there were some jury instructions. Jury instruction number 1 said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you find that the defendant, George Gordon, stopped, entered, cleared, and paid duties in the port of entry, you must find him not guilty as a matter of law. Jury instruction number 2. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you find that the defendant, George Gordon, failed to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry, you must find him guilty as a matter of law. Now, the government came in and testified that I did not stop at the port of entry. George Gordon took the witness stand, and he too testified that he did not stop at the port of entry. Now, pray tell, all of you advocates of the jury trial, what was it that the jury needed to decide? Well, the jury can only decide the facts, and their job was to decide whether George Gordon had stopped, entered, cleared, or paid duties at the port of entry. The government said he didn't, and George Gordon said he didn't. So that kind of made the job easy for the jury, didn't it? Oh, they'll come back guilty, all right. Why? Well, because I told them to. When did you do that? Jury instruction number 1, jury instruction number 2. You see, boys and girls, this case resolved itself into a mere legal question. A mere simple legal question. The legal question wasn't the Constitution or Article 1, Section 9, and it wasn't did George Gordon stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. It had something to do with something more esoteric than that. The judge asked me this question. Next, he said, did you code plead that statute? Code plead, C-O-D-E-P-L-E-A-D, code plead, legal term. He says, did you do that? I didn't even know what the hell he was talking about. And if you're kind of a novice listening to this program for the first or tenth time, you're probably sitting there saying, yeah, what's that mean? Hey, what's that? I didn't know. So I said, well, I don't know, Judge. I don't know what that means. The judge, remember, an old man now in his 40s, got up from his desk, turned around behind his desk. He had a whiteboard there, and he diagrammed out. Remember how Mrs. Denbo in English class used to diagram out sentences and paragraphs? And she'd show you where the adjectives and the nouns and the adverbs, and she'd diagram a sentence, you know, and then say, well, this is what you got to do. Remembering you didn't pay attention like I did, and I didn't pay attention to Mrs. Denbo or Mrs. Wiles, either one. That's why I don't talk too good to this day. But the judge now, he's going to give me a little lesson here in English and grammar and diction and law and code pleading. And so he wrote that statute up there. Now, remember, you've got that statute right in front of you now, don't you, boys and girls? It says, all trucks loaded with, colon. Remember, that's all trucks loaded with, and after the with, you've got two dots, one on top of the other, called a colon. And then you got this list of 1, 2, 9, 11, 26, 37, 40, remember, 40 things, and it lists everything in the world that you could possibly imagine that you could put on a truck and haul down the highway. It's on that list, and it says, shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in a port of entry, period. That's a colon with just one dot, period. Got that? All right. Got that in front of you? All right. Legal question arises, boys and girls. What trucks are not required to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry? All trucks loaded with. Okay? Here's answer number one. All trucks that are loaded with something that's not on the list are not required to stop, enter, clear, or pay duty at the port of entry. Well, an example of a truck that could be loaded with nuclear waste. Nuclear waste was not one of the items on the list, so if we use the principle that the intent of the lawmaker is the law. Now, if the lawmaker had intended for all trucks to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties at the port of entry, they would have said all trucks shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duty at the port of entry. They wouldn't have made a list of 40 trucks hauling 40 different items, omitting nuclear waste. In fact, there were probably three or four other things that weren't mentioned on that list also. All right, now there's a second classification of trucks that aren't required to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties at the port of entry. Because remember the first four words, it says all trucks loaded with. Empty trucks don't have to stop either. So remember that prima facie break, and I move to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. And he sat bolt upright and he said, what did the state fail to prove? And I said, I don't know. And he said, I do, but I won't. He knew. Empty trucks don't have to stop at the scale. How did he know that? How did he know that empty trucks didn't have to stop? Well, because, you see, it says all trucks loaded with. So the intent of the lawmaker was for trucks that are loaded, and trucks that are loaded with these things shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duties at the port of entry. Trucks that are loaded without these things or trucks that are empty don't have to stop. And you see, boys and girls, you learn something right there. The intent of the lawmaker is the law. And if the lawmaker had intended for empty trucks and trucks loaded with nuclear waste to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties at the port of entry, they would have listed nuclear waste trucks and empty trucks in the list. And they didn't do that. If they wanted all trucks, irrespective of what they were hauling, to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties at the port of entry, then they would have put that on the list. They would have said that. There wouldn't be any list on there. It would just say all trucks shall stop, enter, clear, and pay duties. By putting the list on there and omitting nuclear waste and a few other odds and ends that you could think of that weren't on the list, those trucks didn't have to stop. And so the state had to prove as a part of their prima facie case that my truck was loaded number one, that it was loaded with something that was on the list number two, or three, that the truck was loaded with something and it was not empty. They didn't prove that my truck was loaded. They couldn't prove that it was loaded or empty, and of course I failed to prove that the truck was empty, and the jury came back, and do you know the judge was a prophet in his own time. They found me guilty, came back and said, we find the defendant guilty. I went on to win the case on the counsel issue, which was a collateral issue. The judge denied me counsel. Can't do that under Argersinger versus Hamill. Fined me $75. Later on, I prevailed in the appellate process, but, doesn't answer the merits of the case, does it? The merits of the issue. Alright, so now we know the answer is empty trucks don't have to stop in or clear and pay duty at the port of entry. Not exactly the outcome I was looking for, but better than the swift kick in the hiney. So I went back to the factory and we decided that we would do another test. And this truck had some holes in it. You know, it was a van type body, but you know, it had rivets that were out and it had holes underneath the floorboard, you know, of the cargo bay. And so we went back and we fixed all the holes. We took tin can lids, you know, coffee can lids, and nailed them down over the knot holes that had broken out of the floorboards. And we put the rivets back in, put a new seal around the door, and then we built a plywood battlement up on top of the van body and nothing underneath it, of course, and we stretched a tarp over the top of it. So we had a tarp over an empty spot, and then we had an empty van. And of course, if you were a truck driver, you'd know immediately this truck is empty because this truck's not sitting down on the overload blocks. So I took it down to King's Hill, and when I got to King's Hill, I let some air out of the tires so that the tires would look like they were, you know, kind of flat on the bottom at least. And so then I started up King's Hill toward the weigh station at Bliss, and of course I had it in fifth over, going up this slight incline about 40 miles an hour, and of course the truck was kind of lugging down, going clunk, 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 clunk. And as I went by the scale, I gave the guy the finger. Now remember, the week before, the jury just convicted me for doing this, turned around, gave the scale master the finger as I went by, and Mogan, Dunn, and Johnson were out there at milepost 384. I mean, they had me before I got to the right at the next milepost. Mogan said, hey, Gordon, how come you didn't stop at the scale? And I said to Mogan, and I said, well, why would I stop at the scale? What's your probable cause for making this intrusion into my Fourth Amendment protected rights? And he said, Idaho Code 49-27. He said, you're under arrest. He said, it's either that or you can turn this truck around and we'll go back and weigh it. So I mulled that one over for a minute and I said, okay, now my truck is out on the highway. And I'm afraid that if they arrest me and call a tow truck, the tow truck's going to pick this thing up and haul it away and he's going to testify, hell, that truck was empty. We couldn't have that in a test case going clear to the Supreme Court, now could we? So I says, okay, I'll follow you back and let's weigh it. So Mogan took the lead. We went up to Bliss. Had a cop car in front of me and a cop car behind me. And we went up to the Bliss overpass, went across the overpass, and then headed back north on Highway 80. 84, I think it's called now. Got up to a median divider, crossed the median divider, and I'm following Mogan. Mogan pulls into the southbound weigh station, Bliss, Idaho. And he heads down the ramp to the scale. I went straight ahead to the parking lot behind the weigh station. Mogenden wheels around the weigh station, pulls up in front of me. I jumped out of my truck, slammed the door. I had the ignition key in my hand, and I threw it as far as I could up into the weeds. Mogenden said, you're under arrest. I said, okay, I'll go quietly. So they called for backup. They had about four or five cop cars there, and they had a bunch of guys, and they're just going over my truck, you know, like a batch of monkeys going over a pile of bananas, and they were looking under it and over it, and they were looking around it and in it, but they didn't break in. And then I had a guy, in fact, I had three witnesses in the chase car with a Polaroid camera, and those were the days before we had videotape, you know. days before Rodney King. So they're taking Polaroid pictures. What we were hoping for is that they would break into the truck without a search warrant. Well, they didn't take that bait, but they were underneath it looking for holes that they could look inside, and there wasn't any holes because we fixed all of that. So they went inside and they called Judge Becker. And they were talking to Judge Becker. Now, he's about, I don't know, 10, 15 miles away over in Gooding. We're in Bliss. I don't know how far it is over there, 10 miles or something like that. It was about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, so obviously they called him at home and trying to get a warrant, and I couldn't hear both ends of the conversation. But Mogenden said, now we don't know what it's loaded with. Well, it's got to be loaded with something, you know. Well, he's really acting suspicious. Well, we don't know what he threw into the weeds. Now, I'm under arrest. They've already searched me. They can't find any keys. They can't find jack squat. And bottom line was, well, if you want a warrant, then you got to come over and sign an affidavit and tell us what you're looking for. They didn't know what they were looking for. So they didn't take the search warrant bait, which is kind of a tragedy and a sting operation, but then it's not the end of the world. It's just not good. So we were scheduled for trial. So I was given a ticket. Gave me a ticket for failing to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. And the case was scheduled. And I went down and I filed a motion to bring the case to a motion hearing. It was a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case in a preliminary hearing, which requires judicial discretion and a misdemeanor. So you're not entitled to a preliminary hearing and a misdemeanor, except by judicial discretion. So I said, well, I've got an offer of proof, and the judge now has to listen to my offer of proof. So he scheduled it for oral argument, and we went back to Gooding County Courthouse, and we went into the little courtroom. It had two courtrooms. I have a big one, I have a little one. The little one only has two rows of benches, probably room for 30 people total. The courtroom was packed. Now, I only came down with six people. I came down with three witnesses to testify. And I had three friends that wanted to sit in and watch. And the courtroom was packed. I mean, every highway patrolman, I think, in Idaho was there. If not, there was a lot of people there that weren't highway patrolmen. But they must have been government people because they were really interested in what this crazy lunatic Gordon was up to over here. And especially since he had just been convicted for this very thing, same thing, you know, just a couple of months before. And so it's my motion hearing, so I have to go first. So I got up, and I had about 25 questions. I called Officer Mogenden as my first witness. And I asked Officer Mogenden a series of what we call foundation questions, you know, just to kind of qualify the guy for witness. And you know, I asked him what his name and address and telephone number and how long he'd been with the force and what did he do for a living. And on August 10th or June, I guess this was June 19th, but on June 19th, 1978, what were you doing? Got into the milepost and one thing and another. Question 18 was the ringer. I said, what was the truck loaded with? And he said, I don't know. I asked him some questions about, you know, who owned the truck and was Gordon drunk, and did you give him a sobriety test and check his license, registration, insurance, and everything was copacetic? What was your probable cause for making the stop? And got all that information on the record. 25 questions later, I said no further questions, and the prosecutor cross-examined and called in the scale master, called in the backup trooper, and that was about enough. And so, judge came back and he said, now, Mr. Gordon, he said, if you put this case on to trial, have you got any scientific evidence? Have you got any pictures? Have you got any other witnesses, evidence, or testimony that you intend to present? And I said, oh, yeah. Well, yes, sir, I've got scientific evidence. I've got pictures. I've got all kinds of stuff I'm going to present. And he asked the state the same question. He says, now, when this case goes to trial, he says, are you going to present any other witnesses other than those that have testified today? And the government said, no. Got any pictures? No. Got any scientific evidence? No. You got any other witnesses or any evidence that you intend to put on? No. And the judge asked this question. He said, in essence, then, the evidence that we've heard today is essentially the evidence that you're going to present at trial. Is that correct? And the prosecutor said, it is. And the judge paused for a little pregnant silence, and he said, okay, case dismissed. Court's adjourned. He got up and walked out. God, you could have heard a pin drop. You could have heard a pin drop. I turned around and I looked behind me, and the entire listening audience was just stony-faced, silent. And you could tell what they were all thinking. How much did Gordon pay that judge to dismiss this case? What was the payoff? Now, I went on to do that to the government four more times. I did it a total of five times. Five times. The government never did figure it out. I never presented any evidence that that truck was empty. I mean, after all, I didn't have to. Government already, with their prosecution, had said, no, we don't have any other evidence other than he failed to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. And the prima facie case is always going to revolve itself around, was the truck loaded or empty? Was the truck loaded or empty? And the judge told me the answer to the riddle. He said, you know, I've been up to the legislature several times making this argument. And I told him, I said, that statute's flawed. That statute needs to be more specific. It needs to be more precise. It needs to be reworded. And the judicial committee agrees with me, but it never goes to a floor vote, and I never change the statute. And the Supreme Court agreed and said, well, we're not here to make law. And the judge told me, he said, the first guy that can come in here and argue that correctly, I'm going to cut him loose. And the judge cut me loose five times. All right. Now, what's the moral to the story, and what do we learn from this case? We learn that judges oftentimes know the answers to the riddles. Legislators enact laws. Judges construe the effect of the law and make policy. And what's the policy decision that comes out of this case? Well, the police look at the statute, and their testimony is always, well, you see, the sign down the road says all trucks exit next right. But you see, the sign along the highway that says all trucks exit next right isn't the law of Idaho. It's just an advisory sign like slow to 55 or 35 mile an hour turn or school zone or whatever else. It's an advisory sign. It's not the law. The law is in the statute. The law says all trucks loaded with. All right, now here's the moral to this story. Notice that in the first round, the judge said, do you have a driver's license, Mr. Gordon? Is this truck owned by a corporation? I'm claiming Article 1, Section 9. I'm claiming constitutional rights. And did you notice that the judge asked all the right questions in the first hearing? He said, is this truck engaged in interstate commerce? Is this truck engaged in intrastate commerce? Is this a corporation chartered in Idaho? Are you a licensed driver, and is that truck registered? You see, constitutional rights supersede the law that's being applied to the person who has that constitutional right. Policemen will arrest somebody, and they have to give them a warning. It says, you've got a right to remain silent. You've got this right, partner. But you can surrender your rights based upon a contract, based upon an agreement, based upon a license called an adhesion contract. How do we know that? Because the judge explained it to me. It's called code pleading. The intent of the lawmaker is the law. I didn't volunteer to stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. Furthermore, I exercised my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. I didn't answer any questions. The government has a duty to prove that the truck is loaded and that it's loaded with one of those 40 items on the list. The government's argument is they can't do that. They can't do their job unless I stop and let them weigh the truck. Unless I waive my Fifth Amendment right. Unless I waive my Fourth Amendment right to protect my person, houses, papers, and effects. Well, most people voluntarily waive their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. In this case, I didn't. Government came up and made an intrusion and said, hey, how come you didn't stop back there at the scale? Hey, I don't want to talk to you. Is this a criminal investigation? Why don't you read me my rights? Let me shut up. Let me have counsel before I speak. No, I don't want to talk to you, officer. Why don't you come into court? Let's litigate. Why don't you prove your case? The government can't prove their case because unless they open the truck, they don't know if it's loaded or empty. They don't know what it's loaded with, do they? Furthermore, this prosecutor didn't even know what the issue was. He thought that the issue was, well, you didn't stop, enter, clear, and pay duties in the port of entry. I didn't have to stop. I didn't have any agreement. I had a driver's license. That's an agreement. In fact, in Idaho, they have a unique sign that they put out here when you go down to renew your driver's license. It says, don't drive drunk. Your driver's license is an agreement that you will not drive drunk. They got that sign there. That was one of my first clues that a driver's license was a contract. Now, of course, if you don't have a driver's license, that's a crime, driving without a license. But that's another issue. Once you have the license, you've agreed to obey all the laws of the state of Idaho. I agreed that I would stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry. And the government said you didn't stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry. The intent of the lawmaker was, well, not all trucks have to stop, enter, clear, and pay duty in the port of entry. Trucks that are loaded with nuclear waste or trucks that are empty don't have to stop. I had a contract. I had an agreement. I fulfilled my agreement. My truck was empty. I didn't stop. Jed cut me loose. How do I know it's a contract? Cause and effect. Cause and effect. The first guy that can come in here and argue this case correctly, I'm going to cut him loose. Now, if I can't come in there and argue the case correctly, well, obviously, then I must be in breach of the agreement. The agreement says, I've got a driver's license. I agreed to follow Idaho Code 492927. I followed it. It just appeared that the officers involved and the government prosecutor thought that I wasn't obeying the law, that I wasn't fulfilling my end of the agreement, that I had breached the contract. You see, boys and girls, all statutes are contracts. All statutes are agreements. It's an agreement between you and the government as a citizen. I'll show you a little more about citizenship and this agreement that you have with your government and how the government fulfills its obligation and how you're entitled and expected to fulfill your end of the agreement. After all, that's what a contract is. It's an agreement. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. You agree to do something. Whether you call it a license or you call it a contract is a matter of semantics. But that's the way it works. That's the operation. All right, so one of the ways is the courts will tell us the answer to the riddle. But that's not the only way, and next time we'll take a look at some of the other ways that government tells us that these are contracts. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Remember, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I gotta go. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.